Welcome to Almost Heretical. I'm Nate. We have a real amazing interview today with Anna Gazmarian. She wrote a book called Devout, A Memoir of Doubt. And we're going to get into her bipolar diagnosis, mental health, missions trips to Africa, being fired from a church, a lot of stuff. There was so much that it didn't quite all fit into this episode. To hear the full unedited episode, click the link in the show notes right now. Okay, here's the trimmed down, edited version of our interview with Anna. You know, we're going to get into mental health and this that kind of stuff in the interview, but yeah, congrats and yeah, props to you for coming out and sharing your pretty personal story like that.
Yeah, I never thought I would write a memoir because it is very personal, but here we are.
So it's called Devout, A Memoir of Doubt. And I guess I'm curious, you know, we grew up in the church, we grew up in evangelical, you know, conservative churches, and many of our listeners did. Our listeners are all over the place now. We still have pastors in churches, and we have people that do not call themselves Christian anymore that listen to the show. So welcome all of you that are listening along. You're welcome on this journey, no matter where you are. But what led to this, right? So what is your origin story? As we take you all the way back to little Anna, well, you're in a church. How did this all start for you?
So I did grow up in the South and at various evangelical churches that met at like middle schools and auditoriums, you know, that used all their budgets to buy like donuts on Sunday mornings.
Yes, that's the whole reason I wanted to go to church.
Yeah, you got the donuts. And I grew up in those churches. And then I went to a Southern Baptist high school. Strongly do not recommend that. And that was kind of my religious framework. And as I got older, I started dealing with depression, which started to challenge my faith. And I did take a step back from church for a long time to wrestle through those things. And then I'm now back in church, which is a whole journey.
Wow. Yeah, no kidding.
So let's go back into church here. So we had Rachel Held Evans on the show. She talked about the cracks that she first started seeing in Christianity and in her church experience and in her maybe interpretation of the Bible and all these kind of things. So I was like asking, what were some of those first cracks that you started to notice? And at what point in your journey did that happen?
Yeah, so I feel like I didn't really fit the mold of evangelicalism from a very young age because I have the inclination to question things and doubt. And those were things that I wasn't able to have space for. From a very young age, I was exposed to deep suffering. My mom was sick and she was in the hospital all the time. And then, you know, I went to Africa every summer for mission trips and thought I'd be a missionary. And it's funny because when my parents recall stories of us going to Africa, they're always these joyful things. And for me, it was this really traumatic thing of, why would God allow this to happen? And if God has the power and if he is all powerful, why is he not intervening? Hmm. And those were questions that I really grappled with. And I didn't have an avenue to actually understand other than becoming obsessed with Christian apologetics and, you know, going to apologetic conferences, watching debates between atheists and evangelicals and thinking, okay, if I get to a certain theological framework, these questions will go away. And it was this really complicated thing because faith involves having questions and embracing the unknown. But in my mind, it involved being certain. And so that was a huge issue for me. And then another one for me was gender dynamics, because I grew up in an environment where women were supposed to be these complacent, quiet people, and I was the complete opposite of all of those things. And like in high school, I had to get in long distance relationships purposely because I could hide my opinions and just like write them emails. and so I felt this deep feeling of, I don't fit into this box. And if I'm supposed to be this person of faith, how do I adjust myself? Because I can't stop being who I am. And that's honestly how I came to writing, is because I was being told that I wasn't supposed to have opinions and I wasn't supposed to question and I wasn't supposed to do all these things, but like I was able to find my voice on the page. And I didn't feel like I could have a voice in real life, in relationships, but at least I had an outlet to have a voice. And I also think that mental health, when I was diagnosed with bipolar when I was 18, that revealed a lot of cracks for me, because I was taught that suicide was this unforgivable sin, and that if you mm-hmm. struggled with depression or any of these things, that you were going against God. And I realized from experiencing it that all these things, I had no control over them. And they were part of what it means to be human. And it also challenged my belief that everything happens for a reason, because I went through years of trying to find a reason and I couldn't find anything. And that made me really grapple with who I believe God is.
Reminds me of the book, Everything Happens for a Reason and Other Lies I've Loved, which just the title, like that's,
I know,
that's like one of the best book titles I think I've ever heard. But yeah, it is also just a story of when you go through so many different kinds of suffering, like the things you're sharing, your mom being sick, and then these trips to Africa. I mean, that's an incredible, I feel like, thing to throw in there. A lot of us have maybe done a mission trip or two, but you're saying, you know, you guys went every summer yet to a place that has so much just unjust suffering, something that seems so unfair, that like if there is, like you said, an all-powerful God, like why are they not doing something more? Like that's the perfect observation, I think, for a young person to make. And then your own mental health, just I'm glad you brought up that phrase of like everything happens for a reason, because that's one of the phrases I maybe hate the most at this point.
Yeah.
Like there are ways to maybe grow and change through everything, but that doesn't mean everything is worthwhile, and like that everything that's the best that it could have been. Like that just doesn't make sense at all.
I love that you brought up Kate Bowler, because her work has really impacted me, and she writes a lot about the prosperity gospel. Mm. And I remember being young and looking at like Joel Osteen and all these people, like, oh, they're the crazy ones. Like I have it together and they're dealing with these things like I would never believe. But in actuality, like I was living out the prosperity gospel, and I was believing that and thinking that like I was above suffering. And if I followed these rules, if I did all these things, that good things would happen to me.
Yeah.
And that was another thing that kind of broke for me when I got diagnosed, was like, I did all these things. I followed all the rules. Like I didn't drink. I didn't have sex. I did all these things, and all these bad things still happened.
Hmm. Something that, you wasn't because of any choice of your own.
Yeah. Cause I did grapple with like, okay, so what did I do wrong to deserve this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I kept trying to find all these things, cause I was obsessed with journaling my sins. So I kept journaling them and trying to find a sin that caused all this.
Yeah. Oh man. I remember as a teenager, probably especially around like 14, 15, just writing so in my prayer journal, like, yes, exactly what you're saying, of like, I was trying to figure out how I essentially deserved hell, which is the most, I mean, how could anyone possibly deserve that? But I was like, I was starting with the foundation of, I know I deserve hell. So now I need to like, but I was such a good kid.
Yeah.
Like I was such a normal, if anything, above average kid. And so I'm like, oh man, I like didn't want to clean my room this morning. Like, oh, and then I like try and extrapolate that out to how I'm such a horrible sinner, and like, how could God ever love me? And now I read it now, and I'm like, this is absolute nonsense. Like I knew deep down that I didn't deserve hell, but I was like trying to figure out a way how that made sense.
Yeah.
So you all are members of the Boring Testimony Club. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes.
Yeah, we have no.
Like, okay, we've heard this one before when the person gets up to share their testimony.
Yes.
Hey, Brian, do you know anyone that was once a teenage fundamentalist?
Oh, Troy, you know that I was, because you and I have a podcast called I Was a Teenage Fundamentalist.
I did know that. But you know what I find myself asking these days?
No, I don't, but I think you're going to tell me.
What about all those things that church gave us definite answers for? What are we supposed to think about all those things now?
Well, funnily enough, that's what we're doing for season 5 of I Was a Teenage Fundamentalist.
Ooh, Brian, I sense the Lord at work here.
He works in mysterious ways. And we are going to unpack these things. And we're going to find out what we do think about them now.
So tune in to season 5 of I Was a Teenage Fundamentalist, the official podcast for the Azusa Street Revival.
I'm not quite sure that's true, but it is available wherever you get your podcasts.
I think that's really hard for me to, like, I don't believe that I was taught what the Bible teaches. I don't think that the version of Christianity I got when I was young is what Christianity is designed to be. I feel like I got it through the lens of these old white men and their interpretation of it. And I was taught to view God and experience God through the eyes and approval of other people. And so it's really hard for me to look back and believe that I was really taught about Jesus. And I was taught a God of hate and vengefulness and all these things that are complete opposites of what I believe about God now. And so it's hard for me to listen to my testimony and read my journals and do all these things because it feels so distant to where I am now.
So if you had to describe God now and how you imagine God, how would that go?
I mean, I'm going to sound like such a hippie, but...
Yeah, you're on a show called Almost Heretical.
So. Yeah. I mean, I used to say, like, God is love when I was a kid, but it was like all my beliefs did not demonstrate that God is love. All my beliefs dictated that God was angry, judgmental, vengeful, unjust. And so for me, it's like believing that God is love has affected my whole framework. And there are certain issues that I'm like not really sure of. But because I believe God is love, that has dictated like where I landed on those things.
It's interesting that you bring up vengeful, angry.
Yeah.
You know, in my experience, we called that love. We said, but somehow this is the love of God.
Yeah.
You know, he is justified in being those things.
Yeah.
Even though, and this was the hang up for me, especially as I'm a father of three now, but like even before that, I was just like, I know what a good father is. I know what a good parent is.
Yeah.
And I'm told that God is a good parent, but if any human parent was to do those things, we would say, that is horrible. That's horrific, right? And they'd probably be in jail. and they probably should be in jail. But when it's God, there's different rules. And we can say, well, and then you start digging into it too much and you get those like, well, God's ways are higher than our ways. And like, why don't you ask that one when you get to heaven? And all these not very satisfying answers. And that leads to a show like this, right?
Right. And I feel like even in how we were taught to view ourselves as like these sinners, I mean, when we talk about this later, I mean, earlier, but viewing ourselves as sinners and undeserving of love and deserving hell, all these things, while we're also being taught that we're made in the image of God and there's verses about loving ourselves, like, but we're taught the complete opposite messages. And I love that you brought up being a parent because that really reframed things for me of like, how do I want my daughter to experience God in a different way than what I was brought up in? And Rachel Held Evans, she has a children's book, and it's the only Christian children's book that I have for my daughter. Mm-hmm. And in the book, she talks about God being a safe place. Mm. And that really resonates with me because for so many years, and I'm still working through this, God felt everything but safe.
Mm. Yeah.
And that is really what I want to bring to my daughter. I mean, I completely spiraled during my pregnancy. Like, I didn't read any pregnancy books. I was reading all these theology books because when we found out I was pregnant with a girl, I had been praying for a boy because I was like, if we have a girl, I'm going to have to deal with like purity culture shit. I'm going to have to figure out all these things that I haven't figured out for myself. And so I went on this deep dive. Like, I remember one night just reading this huge book about hell. I don't even remember which book it was because I was like, I have to figure out if I believe in hell or not by the time my daughter is born. That was my challenge.
No pressure.
I was like, I got to go to I got to go to the gym every day and then I got to figure out what I think about hell. And it's what I was not expecting is after my daughter was born, being exposed to Christian parent vibes and what that looks like. And like, I really struggle knowing what is the difference between indoctrination and teaching truth. And I don't know what the line is. And I struggle to know how to teach it. And also, like, I want it to be her choice. I want her to be able to choose to live a life of faith because I don't feel like I really had consent over it. Mm. And even like figuring out baptism versus dedication, all of these little things. It's like I find myself every hurdle, I'm questioning everything, and I wasn't expecting that. Mm. Like on the most basic level. And I remember my mom telling me, like, have you started teaching Ezra the fruits of the Spirit? She's 2.5. Like, why would I teach her the fruits of the Spirit? What, like, what is she going to learn from that?
Just live them out and talk about them. Like, she doesn't have to, like, memorize the verse. That doesn't instill it more than...
Right. And I remember my framework for becoming a Christian was out of fear, and it was out of being afraid of sin and being afraid of everything. And that has impacted so much of my life view. And so... I have decided, like, I don't want to talk about sin for many years. And also, like, there's so many stories in the Bible that are not age appropriate.
Yes.
Oh, absolutely. Most of them, probably.
Right. And I don't think that, she needs to learn about Noah's Ark and be scared every time it rains that God is, like, punishing the world.
Yeah. We literally just put out an episode on Noah's Ark, so it's funny that you bring that up.
Oh, I'm so excited. There is a book that I read, I think it's Robert Alter, about the Bible as literature and coming to a point where I don't think that the Bible is completely literal. Like, there's so many, like, beautiful stories that are literary to me and not what happened. And mm-hmm. I think that has affected the way that I want to teach Ezra, like, the beauty of literature and, like, what that can teach us about God and how stories are used and what they communicate, but not necessarily being like, hey, you know, Job was afflicted by God and Satan was just watching. Like, I want to be trauma informed in how I teach her about faith.
I think what I've found is apparently, like, a lot of these things don't come up. Like, it's not like, oh, yeah, I mean, sin just popped up today. We got to talk about it. You know, it's like they're just living their life. And you realize, you know, this framework that I used to have about everyone, which I was raised very Calvinistic, and I was in churches where I was teaching Calvinism, things like that, but was that everyone is starting out total depravity, right? The tea and tulip, like total depravity or original sin, all these ideas that you are completely separated from God. And if you're like hardcore out there, you probably just got like the image of the two cliffs, right? And then there's God on one side. And
stop it. I remember memorizing that.
It would always bug me. I've said this on the show a lot, but the cross that fits in the middle, I mean, it fits, but then how do you get over the top of the cross? Like, they never drew a ladder. I don't know.
It just doesn't quite make sense.
Yeah. That whole idea that we are separated, there's something wrong with us from the beginning. I just don't view humans that way anymore. So now as raising these little humans, it doesn't come up. I'm not like, man, we got to really get them on a different path here. You know,
it's interesting because I feel like watching a lot of my friends become parents as well, friends who are a lot more still maybe in the Christian world that I'm not as much anymore. It's remarkable to me how quickly you can see sin if that's what you're looking for. Like how at such a young age, like 1 or 2, be like, oh, well, you know, they're throwing a tantrum because they're, you know, a naturally sinful being. And it's like, well, or you could just go from the psychological perspective of they're throwing a tantrum because, they don't have the emotional capacity to understand all these things and they're upset and they're hungry and they're tired and like you would throw a tantrum too. And just, I feel like sin is such an unhelpful concept because it basically just says like, well, you're just bad and there's nothing really you can do about it except, you know, hope that God helps you. And of all the things, like we said, you know, we have an 8-year-old and 5-year-old, but the 8-year-old, you know, she'll ask tons of questions. She's super smart. Always, you know, the other day we ended up talking about, I mean, she asks about, you know, death and we were talking about, you know, what is hell? Cause she'd heard people use the word hell. And so we have all sorts of conversations. She's never once, like never once have we needed to talk about sin. Like it's just not a natural, it doesn't come up because it doesn't really fit in just the way life works.
Right.
Like people do bad things.
Yeah.
Like what we usually talk about is that people who do bad things are often like there's been things in life that have led them to that point. That doesn't make those things okay. Yeah. But like there's reasons behind, you know, she'll talk about like people who are in jail and like, are those bad people? And we're like, well, you know, I don't know that they're bad people. They're just probably people who've either had hard times or didn't get the help that they needed. And, you know, so we needed, there's just, anyway, all that to say, I think it's so easy to not use sin as a framework anymore.
Yeah. I love that you brought that up because I was going to go on a rant about that, about, I've had so many people be like, so don't you notice how much your daughter is a sinner? And oh, it's the complete opposite for me. Like, mm-hmm. I look at her and I am in complete awe, because I think about, like, Jesus being with children and Jesus always welcoming them when people dismiss them. And I feel like my view of God has changed by becoming a parent and just seeing, like, the innocence and the joy. And side note, just like her not being influenced by the patriarchy in any way and her being like unapologetically herself, it's been so healing for me. And I think for me, it's like one of the things I want to teach her is that people are made in the image of God and there is a divine nature to people. And I feel like the most poignant images I've had of God have been through other people. Hmm. And they haven't been in church.
Hmm. I want to come back to, so a lot of the book deals with mental health, deals with your diagnosis. And then a piece that we haven't gotten to is, so when you receive that diagnosis, and then I'm assuming you're still in the church at that point, do you take that sort of, take your new diagnosed self back to the church? And how does that process go? How are you received in this state? Are you honest about things at that point, or
do people know how to respond?
Yeah, how does that go?
There's a lot. So I was the one that brought myself to the psychiatrist because I grew up in a culture where science was something to be mistrusted. Yeah. Like, even in thinking about my appointment, I remember being like, oh, she's gonna say stuff that makes me seem selfish and focus on myself and not focus on a higher power. And wow. I, before going to the psychiatrist, I had gone to a Christian therapist, and I didn't know that there were different types of Christian counseling. And the one that I went to viewed every mental illness as a problem with, like, sinful behavior. So she didn't even mention anything. And I didn't tell her that I was having suicidal thoughts. I wasn't honest with her. Like, so I can't put that on her, because in my mind, it was like, these are things that I just need to deal with in my faith and they'll go away. And when I got diagnosed, I did go back to my parents, who were evangelical, and they were very welcoming and accepting. And that is something mm-hmm. that I recognize okay. as a huge gift, because most people do not have that. But I was not welcomed by my church. I mm-hmm. had, before my diagnosis, a falling out with a guy, and they told me that my depression was a distraction from this guy. And so I was let go from the church.
What? Oh my gosh.
Let go from the church. What do you mean by let go from the church, and how did that happen?
Like, I was told, like, I was kicked off the leadership team and told that I was a distraction to him. Because there was all these things, like, he sexually assaulted me, all these things happened, but, like,
oh my gosh.
No one heard my side of the story. Mm. They were just like, you are tempting this guy sexually. Ugh. You are, I mean, this is like my purity culture book that I'm working on. You're tempting this guy sexually, like, your depression and your sadness is keeping him from God. And so you need to leave. And so I thought that my diagnosis was because I was being punished from that relationship, because I was like, I made this guy interested in me.
Oh, so you kind of like internalized what they were saying about you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I was this is all my fault. And I remember I went to a counseling session with a therapist right after everything happened. And he was like, why are you not angry? Like, he pointed all these things out to me, kind of like what you're saying, like what broke the cracks. And I didn't see any of it. I was like, why would I be angry? Like, this is all my fault. Like, I could not. No. My friends tried to speak into it and they tried to give me a different vantage point, but I was so indoctrinated that I couldn't see it. And I, like, in retrospect, the diagnosis isn't what broke me. It was the Christian messages that I had been taught about suicide, the Christian messages I've been taught about, like, suffering. And so that happened. And then shortly after my diagnosis, a pastor gave a sermon about him being in rehab and him having bipolar. And I remember being so excited. I was like, okay, this is going to help me learn. And instead of it being like a way of like coinciding faith and mental illness, it was like, this is how I got through it. This is how I got healed. This is, and him apologizing like for his diagnosis and apologizing to his wife and like making it this like sinful affliction.
Oh,
so that went on. And then one of my best friends got diagnosed with bipolar, and she went to a chiropractor, a Christian chiropractor, which I didn't know was a thing. And she thought she was completely healed because she was getting her back adjusted. And so I had all of these other messages going on that I was so entrenched in that I really didn't know what to believe. Like, my church at the time had this thing where they would, like, a graph of all the mental illnesses and sicknesses, and then the sins coinciding with all of them. So
what? Oh my gosh.
You just said that like it's totally normal.
Like, where in the world does this come from biblically? Like, how is there any, I mean, well, they probably have a verse to back up everything, but yeah. I am enraged right now. Okay, keep going.
Yeah. So they had this list, and for me, depression was linked with selfishness because all my mind was consumed with was like keeping myself alive. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm not thinking enough about God.
Wow. Yeah. I think that chart was probably written by someone with no mental health struggles. Just...
I know, or like who had never read the Bible and realized that Jesus was suicidal, but that's a whole different thing.
I mean, you're right, he does say that.
Wow, that's true.
At what point do you become angry at some point?
So I'm 31 now, and I was 18 then, and I feel like I'm just now getting angry.
Wow.
And that was one of the hardest things about writing the book. Is I was like, oh, I process all this stuff. And then as I was writing it, it was like, oh, this has all been stored in my body. And this is all things that I haven't processed. And so I joke with my friends that I'm like this constant ragey Anna. I am angry about the bipolar stuff. But I think for me in the present day, like purity culture is even a bigger thing. And I think that was connected with my diagnosis.
Yeah. And did you say you're working on a book about that now?
Yeah. Yeah. I tried really hard to avoid it, but I'm really interested in like how purity culture continues to be a thing and grappling like with what I want to teach my daughter about sexuality is a whole spiral for me. She's 2.5 and I'm like talking to my therapist about like the impact of casual sex, what I think about it, like, is my evangelical upbringing impacting my view on sexuality still? Like, how do I untangle all these things? So that's a fun thing to deal with while you're having a toddler.
Hey, well, good for you for wanting to untangle those things now.
Yeah.
I can't wait to read that book.
Yeah. I guess I want to go now to your relationship with church. You said you've gone back to church now.
Yeah. I left church after my diagnosis for a while, and I was in Winston-Salem. I grew up in Winston-Salem my whole life, and then after my freshman year, I moved to Raleigh, and I got involved in Campus Crusade for Christ.
Oh, okay.
And obviously that didn't help. And then I went to a mega church for a few sermons, and I remember there was a time when I went to the prayer room to get prayer for healing, and there was like a married man there, and I grew up in a culture where like there were some married men that would not pray with women. And he kind of just looked at me and I was like sobbing and he just completely ignored me. And then there was like a college boy that walked in and then he immediately gravitated to him and prayed with him.
Wow.
And I was just like, I can't keep doing this. And
wow,
I got to a point when I was in Raleigh, like I was reading Henry Nouwen and I was reading these books that preached a very different message than when I grew up, but I just could not internalize it because I think there was this anguish that I felt that didn't feel like it had a place in Christianity. And so I was really starting to question, like, am I even a Christian? And all of this was happening outside of the church. And I remember reading the story about Jesus in the desert and reading about Jesus sweating blood and just like, I couldn't relate to Christians anymore, but I could relate to Jesus and I could relate to the agony that Jesus felt. And that is really what connected me to Christianity and kept me searching. And eventually I left Raleigh and I moved to Michigan because I found out Sufjan Stevens attended this really small school. I'm like, okay, so it's got to be okay. And that was the biggest turning point for me because I left all reminders of my upbringing. Like, my parents weren't driving distance away from me. I was completely on my own. Like, there was a church there. There was chapel. I didn't go to anything. I just turned to writing. And I found Lamentations. And that was the biggest turning point for me in my spiritual journey and what made me start questioning my faith and questioning my experiences in a way that, like, oh, there's another way to embrace faith. And there's this entire chapter and section of the Bible and Psalms that everyone purposely overlooks because they don't know what to do with them. So I didn't go to church in college. And then after I got married, found out that there was a church that studied Lamentations. And I was like, I gotta go there. And it was this community where I could be really honest. And I remember I was at a Bible study and this woman showed up manic. Because I can spot mentally ill people like that. And she shows up manic and everyone just treats her so lovingly. And I find out that like one of the women in the group takes her to ECT appointments. And just the way they responded to mental illness was really amazing. I will be honest that writing the book did really challenge my faith and made me like get to this point of being really tired of relying on other people, especially men, to tell me what to believe about God. So as amazing as this church community was, I am currently taking a break from church because it's like, I want to experience God. I want to figure out what I believe separate from people telling me what to believe. And I think becoming a parent made it even more challenging for me because it was like, I don't fit in this Christian mom mold. And being surrounded by it is really hard for me because it feels very stifling. And it's like, I don't think that becoming a parent and being a person of faith means that I have to find my entire identity about around this. And how do I integrate this into who I am without making it like my entire purpose? Because even if like you say, okay, well, gender roles don't have to exist in like these liberal churches or whatever, like I still see them popping up. And it's still really hard for me to engage with.
Yeah, that's incredibly powerful. Like, just there's so many facets of your story that I think are so many of us have experienced. I mean, you know, sure, it's a small percentage that have experienced being diagnosed bipolar, but the way that has like connected with so many other facets is just really fascinating. And I'm really proud of you for wanting to figure it out on your own for a while and maybe find other inputs, other sources other than just, white men. Some certain people have had the platform for far too long and and they just might not be right about everything. They might not be malicious, but they just might not be right either.
And I think I want to have this space in my faith for what I don't know. And I feel like I've relied so heavily on other people to tell me what to believe and to feel the sense of certainty that like, even while writing my book, I would find myself going to theology books. I'm like, okay, I got to get to this conclusion. There was a review of my book where they complained that I didn't come to answers of why I believe in God. Cause I still don't know, honestly. I'm like, that's kind of the whole point.
You're like, well, then I think I wrote it correctly.
Yes, that's exactly what my editor said. He called me. He's like, I'm going to frame this because this means that like we did what we were supposed to do.
Oh, that's
but while
awesome.
editing it, he was like, Anna, you need to stop searching for certainty. Like, this is the whole purpose of your book.
Jeez, editor or therapist?
I joke when people think he's kind of like a prophet because because I didn't view my story this way, but he was like, your story is a testimony and your story is about faith. Because when I started writing it, I was like, oh, I didn't have faith in like multiple areas of my life. And he was like, you still kept going and like you were alive and being alive is faith. Like choosing to stay alive when you don't want to is a step of faith.
Wow. I'd love if you want to expand on that a little more, just never knowing who's listening and who's struggling.
Yeah. I mean, I love Julian Baker. She's like one of my favorite singers. And I remember there was a review of one of her songs, Claws in Your Back, I think that's what it's called. And she talks about that, about like, there's a line like, living with demons I've mistaken for saints, but just between us, I think they're the same. But the way in which she grapples with it is really beautiful. And when your mind is convincing you that life is not worth living and you are dwelling on and seeing all these different ways that you want to die. I mean, there's been multiple points in my life where like I was sweating and had to leave rooms and like go sit alone because it was like that drive to die. I think about like Jesus in the garden, like sweating blood. Like I identify with that so much because it's like you can't even see what's real. You can't even – I understand – very much why people die by suicide. And for me, it wasn't wanting to die. It was wanting to end the thoughts that were convincing me that life was not worth living. But there was still this hope and this faith, and I didn't understand what it was, but it was like, I still believe that life was worth living, even though everything in me was telling me it wasn't. And there was still this strength, and even if I don't, in the moment, didn't see it as faith, I now see it as this like very beautiful thing that kept me holding on And even if my faith or my hope felt hopeless, the fact that I still chose to get out of bed every day and search for reasons to live was faith and is faith.
Wow, that's beautiful.
Like Shelby just said, like, we don't know who's listening right now. What would you say to someone out there who's maybe where you were 5-10 years ago, confused about their experience they just had in a church, and they're like, maybe it's me, or maybe I just need to like go back and study a little bit more. Maybe I need to, like, what would you say to those, that person out there right now that is where you were, you know, 5-10 years ago?
I mean, there's a lot of things. I think for me, I was so set that churches are a complete reflection of who God and Jesus are. And so I didn't question what I was, how I was treated or the decisions that pastors made. I treated pastors as if they were these sinless, perfect people, and I put them on a pedestal. So I think first of all, like, taking away the power that you put on systems of power and learning to question those things and not putting what you believe about God on people, because that's a very dangerous thing. And that is how toxic systems and religious spheres are created. Also, I think giving yourself space to take a break and heal, because I didn't think I could do that, because there's such a stigma against deconstruction and having to leave and dealing with spiritual trauma and thinking, no, I just need to keep exposing myself to this. If it is toxic for you and you're triggered, like, it's okay to leave. And that's not a reflection of your faith. That is like you taking care of yourself. And I think that we are called to take care of ourselves, and that sometimes involves leaving toxic spaces. I also think studying the Bible in a way that makes you recognize even how Jesus responded to religious people. Like, Jesus wasn't in churches hanging out with the most righteous people. Jesus was out on the streets with everyone that religious people ignored. And that for me really resonated, because it was like, all these people were telling me that I didn't have enough faith. All these people were telling me that I wasn't strong enough of a Christian, and that is why I was suffering. Meanwhile, those were all the people that Jesus was like rebuking and calling out and like tossing tables with. That's not who Jesus was with. And so that like solidarity of, it's okay to be where I'm at, and I don't have to keep striving to be this person that I'm not.
Hmm. Yeah.
Man, I've just loved every facet of this conversation. I could pick your brain about a lot of things, and I can't wait to see where the books that you continue to write, and questions about resources of that have been helpful to you, and also like, where can people find out more about you and what you're up to as you continue?
Yeah. So I do have like a list of books at the back of my book that have like guided me through my faith journey, and I'll try to remember some of them. Christian Wiman was a huge influence on me as a writer, as a person of faith. My Bright Abyss is a book that he writes about his relationship with poetry. I didn't really talk about it on the show, but that's like a huge component of my book, is looking at like the spirituality of writing and viewing writing as a prayer and something that connects you with God, and like looking to connect with God in unconventional ways. Is definitely how I have maintained a person of faith. I did get into like David Bentley Hart. I got into his work about around hell, and that was like amazing. Oh,
that's he did it for me with hell too.
Yes, but also like I read, he was like, I was like 8 and I was sitting there and I was like, oh, this hell thing doesn't work. And I was like, man, I wish I was that smart, but I wasn't.
Yeah, right.
But Rachel Held Evans is a huge one for me. Yeah. And then Sarah Bessie. Mm-hmm. Honestly, like there aren't any books for me that were like, this is how you be a Christian and be mentally ill. Like, I was kind of like, okay, I guess I have to write that book. And that's why I wrote my book.
Yeah, you're contributing to a very unpopulated area of Christian writing. So well done.
Yeah. I think music has been a huge thing for me. Like Sufjan Stevens, of course. There's a song called The Only Thing, and it's about him being suicidal, and then like the beauty of the world, these signs of God being the things that keep him alive. And his music has had a huge influence on me, and like I listen to it throughout my writing process. And then Julian Baker is another one, and she has religious OCD, which I also have, where like I get these obsessive thoughts around my upbringing, and even if I don't believe these things, like they still are very intrusive. And the way she talks about faith and the way that she practices it is very relatable to me.
Wow. Oh man, that's like a whole nother interview we could probably talk about with religious OCD.
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
And horrible.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Anna. Yeah. The book is Devout. Anna Gazmarian is the author. You got to go check it out. I just think get following Anna now, because there's much more coming here, and the book on purity culture and all this stuff that's coming. So it's a good follow on all the social networks too. Yeah. Super glad that you were able to come on here and talk to us.
Yeah. It's really been an honor to have this conversation. Thank you.
Yeah.
It's been fun.
Yeah.
Thank you.